Hello and welcome to Constitutionally Sound, a monthly podcast from the Centre on Constitutional Change at the University of Edinburgh. I'm Alan Little, I'm a journalist and broadcaster, and in this episode today we are going global, exploring Scotland's international relations. Now, as world leaders descend on Glasgow for COP26, we'll be exploring how much scope there is for the Scottish Government as a devolved government to have a presence on the international stage. The Scotland Act 1998, the founding legislation of the Scottish Parliament, notes that international relations, quote, including relations with territories outside the United Kingdom, the European Union and their institutions, and other international organisations, regulation of international trade and international development assistance and cooperation are reserved matters and so beyond the lawmaking competence of the Scottish Parliament. So it's going to be Boris Johnson and not Nicola Sturgeon who hosts world leaders as they gather in the coming days. Joining me now are Juliet Carbo, who's a professor in politics at the University of Edinburgh with a personal chair in foreign policy. She's the founding director of the university's Centre for Security Research, and she's been elected as vice president of the International Studies Association for 2022-2023. And Stephen Gethins is Professor of Practice in International Relations at the University of St Andrews and a member of the university's Centre for Global Law and Governance. Many of you will also remember that Stephen was a Member of Parliament representing the Scottish National Party. Welcome to you both. Let's start by exploring this idea of para-diplomacy. Juliet, what do you understand by the term para-diplomacy?
Yeah, it's commonly talked about as when sub-state actors, mainly territories like Scotland, like Wales, like U.S. states, for example, engage in relations across their borders. And it's really fairly common now, especially in federal systems, but also in other systems with some kind of devolved authority. So there's lots of examples, Flanders, Bavaria, California, Quebec, you know, you can find para-diplomacy and city diplomacy as well around the globe.
Give me an example of how Scotland's been involved in para-diplomacy since the Scottish Parliament came into existence.
There are many examples, and I know Stephen has a lot of these that he covered in his book, but Scottish development policy is one example. So starting with Malawi, but now extended to concentrate on four different countries around the world, three in Africa and then also Pakistan. So Scotland has a distinct approach to development policy and development assistance, kind of a people-to-people approach and cooperation with NGOs on the ground. That's just one example. But there's also kind of diaspora relations that Scotland engages in, soft power policies that it holds different events in different countries. Those are just a few examples.
So Stephen, you're the author of a book which came out earlier this year, Nation to Nation, Scotland's Foreign Policy Footprint. What is Scotland's foreign policy footprint? How does it manifest itself around the world?
That's a good question, Alan. It was one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book, was to try and open up that discussion. Scotland has, whether you like it or not, regardless of your opinion on Scotland's constitutional future, has a foreign policy footprint as a well-known international brand. It has a government which is active in the sphere of international relations. So I often think that rather than debate whether or not Scotland has a foreign policy, we should be debating whether or not we're using that foreign policy effectively. And what's interesting is this is not a new thing. So the Scottish Government just didn't start pursuing foreign policy, if you like, when the SNP came to power in 2007. But actually, it was something that previous administrations, pro-union administrations, had pursued very actively. The Conservatives opened an office in Brussels via the Scottish office. They pursued the brand. Labour and the Liberal Democrats opened offices when they were in power in Washington, D.C. and Beijing. And Jack McConnell, of course, established Scotland's first international development fund as well. So Scotland has a wide range of areas where it's active in foreign policy. And I do think we need to discuss whether or not we're being effective in engaging in that sphere. But this is a question for everybody, regardless of your views on the Constitution.
And is it being pursued effectively?
I think it is within the limited scope that we have. The problem that you've got, I mean, one thing I found really interesting, for example, Jack McConnell, the former First Minister, when he set up the International Development Fund, he spoke to then Foreign Secretary Jack Straw And Jack Straw said, well, there's plenty of work to go around for everybody, so why not let's work on this together? I think it's been pursued effectively. For it to be pursued most effectively, I think that you need to have good engagement between the state actor and the sub-state actor as well. So the state actor in this instance being the United Kingdom and Scotland. And if you look elsewhere, Scotland is not the only sub-state actor, as Julie's rightly pointed out, to pursue foreign policy. But in places like Denmark, which works and has a set of rules engaging its foreign policy engagement, along with the Faroe Islands and Greenland, for example, the same goes in Belgium, where the Flemish interact with the Belgian authorities, and in Germany, where the rules for the lander are set out, and the same goes for the provinces in Canada. So I think it's pursuing it reasonably effectively. You've seen Nicola's work on climate diplomacy this week on the run-up to COP, and that'll obviously ramp up. But I think, actually, I'd argue there's scope for growth and for more effective work.
Yeah, no, I was just going to come in and say this broadening of Scottish external relations or paradiplomacy is not unusual compared to other sub-state actors as well. You see, in early days of paradiplomacy, kind of focused more on business and trade, trying to attract businesses into the sub-state region, or maybe kin-state or diaspora relations. But it's broadened to issues of climate, issues of public health, issues of, you know, sub-states taking stances on interventions, military interventions, or nuclear weapons issues. And you see this broadening being more global. So like Scotland, many other sub-states have a hub or an international office in China now. And partly this evolution of paradiplomacy is, you know, the recognition that it's hard to divorce internal politics, domestic politics, devolved politics from international politics. So even though competencies may reside more locally, most of these sub-state actors are recognizing that there's clearly international dimensions to them.
Julie makes a good point, and I note that in Brussels, for example, you know, just to explore how not uncommon this is that there's something like 300 offices of regional sub-state actors in Brussels alone, for example. You know, it's a huge part of the Brussels network.
Let me ask you whether there's a potential for conflict here, because naturally the Scottish government's inclination is to align Scotland's destiny with that of the European Union. And the United Kingdom, of course, has taken the opposite view in departing from the European Union. Well, I want to talk about relations with the European Union in a second, but let me just ask you both whether there's potential for the sub-state and the state, the Scotland and the United Kingdom's foreign policy aspiration, to come into direct conflict. Because if they do come into direct conflict rather than engaging with each other and aligning with each other, then it's going to be the United Kingdom that trumps Scotland at every stage, isn't it?
Yeah, there's always a potential tension between kind of the center and sub-state external relations. Sometimes these are complementary, and I think development policy is a good example. Early on, Scottish development policy and UK development policy, they pursued those policies distinctly, but they complemented each other, and there wasn't really a conflict, was not really seen. But with UK foreign policy kind of getting rid of the development office and decreasing its development budget, foreign aid budget, then there's the scope for mixed messages or different trajectories. Europe may be, as you put your finger on it, Europe may be the most important kind of potential area in which Scotland and the UK are diverging, although the UK still is going to have relations with Europe, still is part of NATO. To cut it short, there is a potential for conflict. Again, this is not new. Sub-states and center governments kind of have to work this out. You're absolutely right. In the end, the UK is the sovereign state and has the reserved powers, and others will listen to the UK, even if they have sympathies for what Scotland is trying to do in its external relations.
Stephen.
Julie's right. There will always be conflict. But Alan, if you think about politics, if we all agreed with each other, well, life would be very boring, but that wouldn't be terribly democratic either, would it? Now, if you have different governments in Holyrood and at Westminster, you will have differences. So there will always be an element of conflict. And you don't just see that in the UK, you see that elsewhere as well. But what you get elsewhere in places like Germany, Belgium, Denmark, Canada, the United States, is you get a framework for governing these conflicts. But of course, with devolution, and this is a whole other debate, of course, you actually have that framework. But of course, the UK never inbuilt a framework when devolution came in 1999. So how do we take that forward? Well, there will be areas of conflict, and I think we just have to be comfortable with that, that we will have differences of opinion. That's the whole point of devolution. But I think that Julie touched upon something really valuable there, which is, where do the different governments complement one another's work? And I think about the diaspora. So if you like, Scotland has a very, very big diaspora, and people who are part of the diaspora recognize themselves part of the Scottish diaspora rather than the British diaspora. And I remember during the in the immediate aftermath of Brexit, when the UK was trying to reach a trade deal, some members of Parliament who were Brexiteers, who were getting frustrated about why the UK government didn't try and reach out to, say, the Scottish diaspora in the United States as a political tool in the way that other governments reach out to their diaspora. Also in areas like climate change, you will see sub-state actors who are integral parts of their delegations who will turn up in Glasgow this week, because, you know, not only do they complement each other's work, but when you have agreements reached at a high level, say in Glasgow at the COP summits, they're not implemented by the sovereign national governments. The agreement will be enacted by the devolved administration, by the local authority, by the city authority. And that's why in other countries they actually build this into the system.
Let's move on and talk about the European Union. I want to talk in a few minutes about what foreign policy of an independent Scotland might look like should that ever happen. But first of all, let's examine the major constitutional change that has already been implemented. That is the United Kingdom's decision to leave the European Union in the face of a decisive vote in favour of staying in Scotland. How has that changed both the UK's foreign policy and the way in which Scotland should seek to continue to engage with the European Union? Juliet.
Yeah, so I think there's been a big change in UK foreign policy to begin with. You see after Brexit, the United Kingdom kind of casting about for different roles on the world stage, if you will. And not all of these have been accepted by other international actors. Some of the policies have been seen as by others as bringing up kind of uncomfortable and unwanted colonial overtones. So naval support facility in Bahrain, putting the UK, quote, back east of the Suez, has a ringing in some people's ears that harkens back to a historical time that people don't want to go back to. Global Britain, this idea of playing a global Britain role, has been accepted by some trade deals, the nuclear submarine cooperation agreement between the UK, the US, and Australia, although we've seen this is not without cost in UK relations. But how much this has affected Scotland is and Scottish external relations, whether independent or not, is unclear, because so many international actors opposed Brexit, and because they're not really accepting some of these roles that a post-Brexit UK foreign policy is trying to play. There's more sympathy for Scotland, I think, to pursue its external relations in the current constitutional setup or otherwise. And some other states may welcome Scotland's role in the Arctic, in climate change, because it supports their roles and their interests in these issues. But Brexit also complicates what Scotland is trying to do more generally. Many see the UK as already diminished post-Brexit, and this makes kind of Scottish external relations and its paradiplomacy that's kind of automatically seen through the lens of inevitable bid for independence by other actors a little bit more problematic. Those who want the UK as a strong ally militarily and economically don't want further changes in the UK's capabilities, don't want a divided UK or UK kind of preoccupied with Scotland. So, and right or wrong, there's some people out there in the world, and we saw this as a reaction to Scottish independence referendum, that see Scotland's external relations as more devolution, as more balkanization, as more kind of nationalism. Again, right or wrong, there are people out there that see that and worry that this is just more of a Brexit, more of a breaking down and breaking apart.
Let's come on to the question of independence and how it would be received or how it's viewed by other European powers in particular in a minute. But first of all, let me just pause, Juliet, there for a second. In the trade deals that post-Brexit UK has been striking around the world, are there any trade deals now that move us on from the trade relationship we already had as a member of the European Union?
Well, I think Alan would just concede I'm pretty biased on this. I don't see any trade deals that have enhanced the situation you've got with the EU. And I know that the one, you know, for example, even the one that was hailed with Norway, the Norwegian Prime Minister came out and said, yeah, that's fine. It's great to sign this deal, but this is nowhere near as good as the one that we had previously. And even, you know, countries like Australia, New Zealand, Canada that were hailed as a future by Brexiteers before the EU referendum are not as good. And ambassadors were telling people this before the Brexit vote. But Alan, you know that I'm a little bit biased on all this. So
you are. Let me ask you then, you agree, Juliet?
Yeah, I would agree that. And that's an example of what I was talking about how the UK has been kind of trying to establish itself as a trading partner, as a global trading partner, and others aren't taking it up in the same way that's anywhere comparable to the position it had within the EU.
Yeah, Stephen, pick up on Juliet's point there, that there is a lot of sympathy for Scotland out there, but any attempt to flex its muscles by Scotland on the international stage is inevitably going to be seen by other countries, particularly in Europe, as a further progress down the road towards independence. And as we know, you just have to speak to any diplomat based in London from a European Union country. There is hostility to the idea of Scottish independence. They see it as balkanization. They see it as destabilizing. They want strong relations with a sovereign United Kingdom. Does that hamper, do you think, Scotland's attempts to extend its foreign policy footprint?
No, I don't think it does. In terms of the hostility, I'm not sure it's entirely there. I mean, let me just deal with this a little bit. Look, you were right, Alan, to talk about Brexit being major constitutional change. And one of the many lessons of Brexit is that you need to talk about what your foreign policy is going to be before you undertake that major constitutional change, which is why conversations like this, I think, are so valuable. If you look at the UK, as Julie pointed out, there were disagreements between prime ministers, foreign secretaries and permanent secretaries at the Foreign Office on what global Britain even meant. You've seen the UK falling out with its nearest partners in Europe on submarine deals, on turning to Indo-Europe, the fact that, you know, some key partners weren't even mentioned in the Foreign and Strategic Review. And the great cleavage that now goes to the heart of constitutional debate in Scotland is one of how we see ourselves in the world. Is it one of an increasingly unilateralist view of the world, which is Brexit Britain, because that's the outward and away from Europe? Or is it one that Scotland would have to embrace, which would be one of multilateralism and pooling and sharing its sovereignty, but also working more closely together on security issues with our European partners? Now, in terms of sympathy for Scotland, what does this do? What this does is, yeah, there are some elsewhere who don't like upheaval, who don't like change, but actually other countries, and they've been very clear on this, will remain neutral on the question of independence. Because one thing that people in Scotland need to understand is that, of course, until the moment that Scotland becomes independent, any questions about Scotland's foreign policy footprint, how we interact with the rest of the world, is an internal matter, and other states are loath to get involved in what they consider internal matters. That being said, one thing I've picked up in different parliaments around Europe and in the diplomatic service is that there's an increased understanding of the situation. And actually, you know, domestic policy is the most important thing for any politician. So the greatest thing in foreign policy you can often look for is understanding, rather than, you know, Angela Merkel or Emmanuel Macron coming up to chap doors in Perth or Strathmiglo or Dundee, for that matter. They will not get proactively involved, but I think capitals will want to understand Scotland and understand that it takes its responsibilities as a potential actor on the international stage seriously.
It is interesting. My own experience as a journalist working in Europe in the period immediately after Brexit was that there is an awareness that Scotland voted to remain and a lot of sympathy for Scotland. One friend of mine in Berlin said to me that at the time of the 2014 independence referendum, there was a lot of hostility in Germany because they saw it as capital N nationalism. But after 2016, the Brexit referendum, he said, Nicola Sturgeon's a rock star in Berlin, a rock star in Germany. So I think it did change European perceptions of what the independence movement was about. So let's assume that Scotland, for the sake of argument, for the sake of this discussion, that Scotland will one day be independent. Leave aside the merits and demerits of independence, and let's look at what an independent Scotland's foreign policy would look like. It will not look like the United Kingdom's or Germany's or France's. It's a much smaller country. What would a Scottish Foreign Service look like, Stephen?
Well, I think the first question you'd have to do, they're hard questions, and this is why we need to debate and discuss this now, is it would look at priorities. What are your priorities? Because obviously you will not have the reach and you can't do all the same things that the British Foreign Service does, but that's the point. You do things slightly differently. The first priority, I think, is going to have to be in reaching out to major trade partners. So first of all, in Europe, you'd probably have to establish representation in all of the EU member states and elsewhere. You would also have to think about your footprint in key partners, places like Canada, the United States, Australia. Then you'd have to think about regional hubs. But Scotland wouldn't be alone in this. So this is something the Irish do, the Finns do, the Danes do, similar size countries do. And the other thing beyond those representations, you'd have to think about what are your core priorities? You know, would it be climate diplomacy? Is that something that you should be prioritising? It's obviously a relationship with the European Union, and you need to think about your security relationship, say, with Norway, with the Netherlands, as well as how you fit into NATO and other apparatus as well. So there's a lot of work to be done, and there are also some hard questions around prioritisation, and that's why we need to be having this discussion and debate right now.
I've lost the line to Julie. So, Stephen, let me put to you the question I was going to put to Julie there. Would an independent Scotland look to countries like, I don't know, Denmark or Ireland, or perhaps even to Norway outside the European Union, as a kind of template for how it would set up a consular and diplomatic service and pursue its foreign policy objectives to the best of its ability, given its relative size?
Yes, I think it would. There are a wide range of countries that would be of a similar size to Scotland with similar resource and international clout that Scotland can look to. You've got, obviously, the Nordic states, Denmark, Norway, Finland, that are a similar size, places like Austria. Closer to home, you've got Ireland, which I think would bear most similarities. And actually, this is something that people in the SNP and other people who are pro-independence are already starting to look at this. But one thing's really important that we all have to remember in terms of this kind of discussion, which is although you can look to others for examples and you can look to others to learn from, Scotland will be Scotland. You know, Scotland's not Denmark, it's not a mini UK, it's not Ireland, it's Scotland. So whereas, for example, on issues like the diaspora or engagement with the European Union or the wider English-speaking world, it can look to Ireland. In terms of security, it most certainly can't look to Ireland because it'd be different questions, and therefore it would probably look to, say, Denmark or Norway or Finland for that matter. So I think there are lots of examples that Scotland can use, but we have to remember that if you're establishing a Scottish Foreign Service, it would be quite distinctive from anything else, although there are plenty of examples we can look at elsewhere in the world.
And the question of Europe, the SNP's policy at the moment is an independent Scotland would go back into the European Union as quickly as it could. But that would pose the very difficult question of relations with the rest of the United Kingdom. Surely, an independent Scotland's most important relationship, even ahead of its relationship with the European Union, would be with the remainder United Kingdom. How would an independent Scotland negotiate that relationship in an atmosphere of almost certain acrimony in the aftermath of a pro-independence referendum?
You're right in the sense that Scotland's most important bilateral relationship is and will always be that with England, or England and Wales and what remains of the United Kingdom. And its most important multilateral relationship will be with the European Union in Brussels. But actually, Scotland would be no different from, say, again, Ireland in that regard. What's Ireland's most important bilateral relationship is with the UK, and that continues regardless of Brexit. But Alan, you're also right to say that whereas Brexit, and let's not forget, right now it's Brexit that is driving support for independence amongst the general public, and that shift from no voters who have shifted to yes. So whereas Brexit might make independence more likely, and in some ways and in some areas makes it more challenging, and there is certainly a challenge around the border with England that has been provoked by Brexit. So I think this is something that will need careful handling. I think it's where diplomacy right now is important in terms of engaging with other European partners before a vote. That's not to ask them to take a position. That's just to try and understand and to set out your position. But also it's to trying to engage with the UK, not just the government, but the wider UK infrastructures right now to try and make them understand and try and find solutions to a problem that may arise in the aftermath of an independence referendum.
One last question, Stephen, a general question about the difference between big countries and small countries in Europe. My own impression is that the big countries, Germany, France, not so much Germany because of its history, but certainly France, even Poland and the United Kingdom, when it was a member of the European Union, tended to see the European integration process as compromising or undermining national sovereignty. Many big countries, of course, were willing to make that compromise for the benefits that were perceived to accrue from membership. Smaller countries, countries like Denmark and Ireland and Finland, take a different view of the European process. And as small countries, they see the European process, European integration, not so much as compromising national sovereignty, but enhancing it because it gets them out from under the shadow of larger neighbours. And Ireland seems to me to be a classic example of this. Before Ireland joined the European community, as it then was, the vast bulk of its foreign trade was with the United Kingdom, and it was very dependent on economic changes within the United Kingdom, the ups and downs of the economic cycle. And now it's only something like 15% of Ireland's exports go to the United Kingdom. The bulk of the rest go to the European Union. Is there a difference between the way small countries and big countries experience and perceive the European integration process?
Yes, there absolutely is. And you see that, you know, if you listen to an Irish foreign minister, Simon Coveney was very clear on this, or if you look at other foreign ministers, and actually in particular the Baltic states, of course, which only became independent about 30 years ago or so, they see the European Union as strengthening and underlining both their independence and their sovereignty. And I was interested to read in The Economist just last week that we're talking about the Council of Ministers, which, of course, is the most powerful body in the European Union where a lot of the big decisions are made, whereby when prime ministers, presidents, heads of governments get together as one person in a room, be it Malta or be it Germany. And in that, smaller countries are able to sit with a group of like-minded states and reach decisions as a bigger group. So you see the way that this enhances, they see this as enhancing their independence and sovereignty. But to do that, you have to be willing to sign up to the treaties. You have to be willing to sign up to the agreements. Sometimes that makes life a little bit more difficult for the politicians, but ultimately it probably delivers better governance. And that's why there's only been one country to have left the European Union in recent times. And that's not seen as a huge success story, whereas other smaller countries very much want to join the European Union. I think the same would be the case for Scotland. Incidentally, when we use the word smaller, Scotland would be roughly a medium-sized country of the EU.
Well, Stephen, I have the feeling this is a conversation we have only just begun to have and which will develop over the coming years. Thank you very much, Stephen Gethins, the author of Nation to Nation, Scotland's Foreign Policy Footprint. Thanks also to Juliet Carbo, the Professor of Politics at the University of Edinburgh. Thank you to all of you out there in the world for joining us again for the Centre on Constitutional Change podcast. Join us again next time. Thank you.